Hola amigos, and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On the show this week, Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna. Those Mexican heartthrobs, they're back on screen together in the hilarious Rudo y Cursi. I'll be finding out what it was like for Gael and Diego to work together 7 years after Y Tu Mama También shot both actors to international fame. And yes, I survived the Edinburgh International Film Festival. All I got was this lousy t-shirt, but I also met up with a host of great names, including Robin Wright Penn and Duncan Jones, son of David Bowie, to name just a few. I managed to see some fine films too, so I'll be bringing you a snapshot of Britain's premier festival of film discovery. Sam Brooks is back and we'll be reviewing another Mexican film, an indie called Lake Tahoe. Emily Blunt is in Sunshine Cleaning and Jack Black is a hunting and a gathering in Year One. Yes, it's better than A Night on the Tequila with Gael Garcia Bernal. Believe me, it really is. It's Film Weekly. This year's 63rd Edinburgh International Film Festival was jam-packed with great cinema and, as is my duty, I spent a few days up there sniffing out the good from the bad. One of the big titles screening early on was Rebecca Miller's The Private Lives of Pippa Lee, which starred Robin Wright Penn and, well, the rest of Hollywood, including Julianne Moore, Winona Ryder, Monica Bellucci and Keanu Reeves. It's fair to say that it was a star-studded indie movie. The story is about Pippa Lee, a housewife played by Pippa Lee, married to publishing titan Alan Arkin, who slowly and nervously unwinds her complicated past in flashback. When I met up with Robin and director and writer Rebecca Miller, she's the wife of Daniel Day-Lewis and the daughter of Arthur Miller, I started out by asking Robin why she'd taken on such a complex role.
I knew you were bad from the day you were born! You!
I find that I don't really have an explanation for that other than, isn't it obvious?
It's a great part.
Robin came at it with so much humility initially, sort of saying, well, initially having embraced and wanting to do the part, but at the same time saying, well, but how do you find, what about a woman who doesn't judge other people? Who's that person? I don't exactly know that person. Mm-hmm. And what about a person who also isn't playing the victim of her own past, a woman who's had this past and yet she's not victimized by it? She doesn't really judge even her own past. There's a kind of acceptance. It's an essence which, you know, Robin, not only did she have to change herself physically somewhat, there's a kind of change of rhythm that happened, a real internal shift, which I think she approaches, you know, it seems to me that your approach, since you're next to me, is a character actor's approach, because you transformed yourself so much in terms of what you're really like. Even though there are parallels, the essence of who you are is so different from Pippa.
Which is absolutely not the truth. Which is so—it's so strange because I am not a trained actor.
Well, but
and I'm just scrambling all the time, going, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know. So in essence, I'm kind of a mimic.
Yeah, but you weren't mimicking anyone with Pippa.
Right.
And you couldn't possibly have been doing me because if you were, you weren't doing.
You're
a very
in trouble.
Good job.
I love that you're still finding richness in the role even now, which I think is fascinating. Can I ask you about playing with Alan Arkin as well? Because an actor, just I think he must be such fun to play with. I don't know him, but I mean, I only know him from his screen roles. I've never met him, but I think he's just a genius. He must be amazing to work with, Robin.
Do we love Alan? We love Alan. I have a funny story. So Alan wraps the movie. It's his last day, and we had such a great time with him. And you know, he's the guy on the set with all the girls. And I said, okay, Alan, I have a confession. What is it? I said, I fell in love with you. I really fell in love with you. I love you. And he goes, you know what? You'll get over it.
And have you?
No, I love you.
So that's Robin Wright Penn, the wife of Sean Penn, and Rebecca Miller, the wife of Daniel Day-Lewis, two of the most intense actors around, and you can see why they fancy these two rather intense women. A conversation that was just delicious, and I was privy to eavesdrop upon it. There'll be more of that interview, a lengthier version, when The Private Lives of Pippa Lee is released fully later in July here on Film Weekly. Light years away from The Private Lives of Pippa Lee, literally, is the debut of British director Duncan Jones. His film Moon is set on the moon. It stars Sam Rockwell in a sci-fi fantasy about the life of a lonely miner plowing the moon for uranium to be the power source back on Earth. I met up with Duncan and asked him how the film developed and, more importantly, how he got such a star as Sam Rockwell to be on board. But first, let's hear a clip from Moon.
Has 3 years is a long haul, you know.
I know you're really lonely up there, but I'm proud of you.
2 weeks to go, Sam.
2 weeks to go, buddy.
I'm going home.
We met up about 3 years ago to discuss a different film, and that film wasn't going to work out, but we got on really well, and it was kind of over the course of that meeting that we decided we wanted to work together. And I said, look, if I write something for you, will you promise to read it? And I'm sure he was sort of fairly skeptical as to whether I'd ever come back with anything, but he said yes. And 9 months later, I came back with the Moon script for him to read, so that's kind of how it all started.
So where did the idea come into your head from when you sit down and write? There's got to be a germ of an idea. Where did it start?
Well, it was a bit of a puzzle, really, trying to put everything together, because I knew I wanted Sam to be the star of it, you know, to be in it. I knew that that we had sort of a lower budget. You know, it was an independent British sci-fi film, so there wasn't going to be a huge budget for it. And sort of that was part of it. And then I wanted a controlled shooting environment because it was my first feature film and I didn't want us to be faffing about going from location to location or dealing with bad weather or anything like that.
So you went for the moon, of all locations?
I went for Shepperton Studios, which is fantastic. And, you know, I've always been a fan of that place. I've shot a few commercials there. So that was really kind of starting to put the puzzle together. And then I had some ideas about, you know, meeting, you know, a person being able to meet themselves and actually interact with themselves. And I just like the initial idea of, as a question, what would it be like for you to meet yourself? And would you like yourself, or would you only see the faults, or, you know, and how would that relationship go?
It got very contemplative, the film, and very philosophical as well.
I think so. I mean, that's probably, you know, stems out from my own, you know, past academia. I did philosophy at university and then went off to graduate school and did philosophy for 3 years as well.
I didn't know that. you talk about some of the sci-fi that influenced, you know, I was almost thinking of Tarkovsky's Solaris as well. Is that pretentious, shall I say that?
It's not pretentious. It's you know, it was a wonderful film. It certainly, you know, was in my sort of background of films that I was aware of and in science fiction. But to be honest, the trinity of films that we were really sort of thinking about were Outland, Peter Hyams' film, Silent Running, which is sort of the great ecological film from the 70s, and then just the first half of Ridley Scott's Alien, because the strange thing about Alien is everyone thinks of it as a sci-fi horror film, but if you actually look at that film, over half of it, the first half of it, is really just quite a contemplative mood setter as what it would be like to actually live on a spaceship before it turns into a horror film. And so that was kind of inspiration.
And again, when Moon is on general release, you can hear more of that interview with the very charming Duncan Jones, who just about looks and sounds like his dad when you see him. He's got the same sort of teeth as the Thin White Duke, and of course, space oddities abound in that family. Now, dance movies abounded in Edinburgh this year. There were at least three in the first few days. There was a great Brazilian documentary called Only When I Dance about a Billy Elliot who jumps out of the favelas and onto the European scene. That's a documentary to look out for, the debut of British director B.D. Finzi. But there was also a film about B-boys called Turn It Loose. It was the debut of British director Alistair Siddons. And I met up with him to find out how he decided to take as his starting point the 2007 World B-Boy Singles Championships in Soweto.
Daisuke! Echo! Daisuke!
Yeah, we set out to make a film that broadened sort of B-boying out to a bigger community. Tried to undo some of the preconceptions as well, because you mentioned breakdancing to lots of people and they either turn their nose up at it or just laugh.
And they think it's just something that happens in Covent Garden still.
Yeah, I think they do, but you know, that hopefully that's what will surprise people about the film. You find it in the Casbah in Algeria and in Senegal and Japan, Korea and South Africa and Brazil and, you know, all over the world. Yeah. So.
What attracted you to this as your debut film? You know, are you a former B-boy?
I'm not a former B-boy, but I used to do documentaries and then I did music videos for a little while, and this was the kind of combination of the two. It's a musical documentary, so it seemed to be kind of tailor-made, you know.
You were very lucky, I think, to get some really good characters. I think that's the key thing to a good documentary. We follow sort of six of your of the competitors. Just tell me about how you did it, because looking at the film, you did. My guess is that you went like the year before to the B-Boy Championships, thought who's good, and then you went around the world following these guys.
Yeah, that's it. We kind of got access to the competition in 2006, about 10 days before it happened, and so I went out and met everyone and did a half hour sort of short documentary about the competition the year before. But it gave me a chance to meet all the people that I like the most, and so then we went and concentrated them on, you know, the next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's lovely when you fill in the lives of these dancers, because they express themselves amazingly through dance, but then to go back and kind of look where they came from and their hometown and their kind of feelings. But that must have been a very interesting journey for you as a filmmaker.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. You know, I think there was a real parallel in lots of their lives. You know, there's sort of identity that B-Boy gives someone, an identity, and whether they've just arrived in America, you know, having come from Mexico, or were living in France from Algeria, they could become a B-Boy and actually almost have a kind of an identity.
Yeah,
I'll say.
Belonging.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So as you can see, Edinburgh really is a hotbed of young British talent. Films are being put on the screen there that perhaps you're never going to see again. It is the one time to see these British films. I think that's a good thing, because sometimes films aren't going to get distributed, but festivals should be about that. They are the place to go and see new talents bubbling under. Well, one such bunch of hopefuls had brought a film called Big Things to the Edinburgh International Film Festival. They're Mark, Luke and Dean, and I met up with them to find out about their comedy. This film is so lo-fi, I tell you, they couldn't afford a tracking shot or a dolly, so they dumped the cameraman in a wheelie bin and pulled him along.
Right, now stay there, stay alone. Just in the, just keep on going in that.
Don't look shit.
No, it doesn't. Just get in the shot.
Oh man, this is. Oh, just stop a minute. Oh. No, just stop, man. Stop. Shit.
We're sitting in the Delegate Centre here at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. We've got three young men, I think I can still call you young guys, who are here with their film, Big Things, a British comedy. Comes out of, where does it come out of, Mark Devonport? You're the writer-director. It comes out of Nottingham?
It comes out of Nottingham.
Like most good things that are British and young. Are you from there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And also, have you set the comedy there?
Yeah, totally conceived, produced and finished in Nottingham.
Yeah.
Made in Nottingham.
And is that a fertile ground for comedy?
I'm not sure if it is for comedy, but it is for filmmaking in general. There's a lot of people that have kind of recently been making stuff and, yeah, seems to be going on there.
Exactly. I mean, I mean, Shane Meadows and Paddy Considine, they're going to be up here a bit later in the week with the film Le Donc. Yep. And they've really put filmmaking in Nottingham on the map, haven't they?
Yeah, and Chris Cook, Steve Shiel, Simon Ellis, and many, many more.
What is it about Nottingham? Is there something in the water?
It just has a really good, vibrant filmmaking community, and everyone kind of mucks in and helps each other out, and it's... Yeah, it's a really positive place to be. Yeah,
this is Luke, of course, who's a star of the film.
No, I'm a producer, actually. But I do star in the film in an extra capacity. Yeah.
Right, everyone does. And in Nottingham films, everyone's in everyone else's films. Because you're friendly with Shane Meadows, aren't you? And you were kind of part of Le Donc in some way.
I was. I'm not sure if I am anymore. part of Le Donc, that is. We're still very good friends.
Right.
But Dean, who's in our film, is also kind of the, you know, secondary lead in Le Donc. He's the rapper Scorsese who Le Donc takes on a tour around wherever it is.
Right. I mean, so Tony, can I, if I bring you in here, what was your role on the film of Big Things?
I played Richard, the guy who makes the film, or tries to make the film in the film. And he's a bit of an idiot, but he tries very hard to sort of like realise his dream.
How much did your film cost for you to put together and to be here?
Well, initially it was £4,000. Yeah, the guy,
My thanks to Mark, Luke and Dean. They're the gang behind Big Things. Wish them the best of luck for it. For more information about the Edinburgh Festival, which comes to a climax this Sunday, the 28th of June, go to the website. There are still tickets available for several of the big events, www.edfilmfest.org.uk. And we give you all the results of who won the Michael Powell Award and the Best New Indie Features. It really was a hotbed of young talent up at Edinburgh this year. Joining me now to review this week's releases, all of which I can safely say were made for more than £4,000, it's Zan Brooks. Welcome back to the pod, Zan.
I was made for more than £4,000 as well.
And you look
only
it.
Only just.
Yeah, just about. Let's see what gold you can cast on this week's reviews. We'll be looking at Year One, Lake Tahoe, and then Sunshine Cleaning. So let's start with Year One. It's Jack Black. It's Michael Cera in a comedy rehash of things like Monty Python and the 2,000-Year-Old Man. They're back in the Stone Age. They're back in biblical times. They're back where it all began, particularly for my people.
I shall on this day circumcise the flesh of my penis and of you. And you, and of you, and of every male who dwelleth hereby.
Excuse me?
I don't know what you mean.
We shall grasp the foreskins of our penises, and we shall cut therefrom the extra flesh. Amen.
Oh, I don't think I have any extra.
Couldn't we pierce our ears or something?
No. So it shall be written, and so it shall be done.
You know, Abe... It's been a long day, we've all had a lot to drink, and I know that this foreskin thing sounds like a good idea now, but you might want to sleep on it. We can always cut it off in the morning. But if we do it now, there's just no way to get it back on there.
No, trust me, it's going to be a very, very sleek look. This is going to catch on. I'm going to go get my good knife.
That's actually quite funny, that circumcision.
Yes, that is funny, isn't it? It's quite annoying to have... what is effectively quite a bad film, but there's about three really good laughs in there.
Yeah.
I think that might have been one
We've
of them.
We've chosen one of them for you. So on the back of that, or the front of it, should anyone go and see it?
I think it's more of a DVD rental, isn't it?
Yeah, when you're really stoned.
When you're really stoned, it's, I don't know. The single joke here, I guess, is that our ancestors were basically... stoners like the characters you now find in a Judd Apatow Harold Ramis movie, which is what this is. So it's basically Jack Black being Jack Black and Michael Cera being Michael Cera. And if you like those two characters, then there's stuff to enjoy here.
Yeah, I mean, I do like Michael Cera.
I do like
his kind of the way he speaks, but can he speak any other way?
Probably not. And I think that Jack Black stands as a sort of object lesson to him of how to adapt or die, really. Jack Black is basically being Jack Black and doing the stuff that we've seen him do for the last sort of 10 years now. And it's starting to look a little archaic.
It's amazing that he could be the person he was in High Fidelity and School of Rock, but do it as a caveman.
Yeah, that's basically the single big joke in this movie.
Is that he can do that kind of dancing and he does that kind of robotics thing. The thing is that they're cavemen and they wander from the hunting and gathering thing, and Jack Black is neither the best hunter nor gatherer of his tribe, and given that that's the only two things that they do, it makes him rather useless. But then they wander through sort of biblical times.
Yeah,
I thought, well, it could have been a bit more sort of, I suppose, am I asking it too much to be historically correct in some way?
I think you probably are. They sort of wander all over the Old Testament here, don't they?
Yeah.
And so that you've got kind of Cain and Abel in there, you've got Sodom and Gomorrah, you've got a lot of things that look like they've been lifted sort of wholesale from Life of Brian. And it's all a little bit wearisome and weirdly a little bit decadent as well. This is almost like the decadent, debauched kind of fall of the Judd Apatow empire that we're witnessing here, where there's all the kind of the cast of characters. Paul Rudd is in there somewhere.
Yep.
You know, is it Christopher Mintz-Plasse who
is in there? He was in Superbad. He was
McLovin. And they're all here, basically, and it's a little bit self-indulgent.
Yeah, it is, and it's slightly flatulent as well, not apart from the fact
there's
a lot of
fart jokes. There's a lot of sort of casual homophobia of a very kind of unreconstructed type, which I guess is fine, because back in those days, you could get away with laughing.
The knuckle-scraping comedy of Year One, starring Jack Black and Michael Cera. Let's move on to pastures fresher and more Mexican. Lake Tahoe is out by Fernando Embiki. This is the guy who I was telling you about ages ago. He made a film called Duck Season, which is about two Mexican kids who sort of stay at home. They were left at home in the flat. Their parents had gone away and they sort of struck up a relationship with a pizza delivery boy. Here again, Fernando Henrique is looking at kind of children left to their own devices by absent parents in a small Mexican town. One boy has crashed his car and he's looking for a spare part.
¿Qué modelo es tu coche?
Es un Subaru.
¿Más o menos sabes cómo es el distribuidor?
Here we go, Zan. A rather sort of short little film, this one, 83 minutes or so, slight, but still, I found, full of kind of important moment.
Well, I think your précis basically sums it up in the most full way that you possibly can. It is a teenager who crashes his car and wanders around looking for a spare part. That's basically it. And significantly, the film opens with him crashing the car, but you don't actually see the car crashing.
Yeah.
And I think Henrique makes films full of scenes that other people would probably cut out of their films. So you just see the sort of car nosed up against a telegraph pole. You don't have the actual smash. And that's really not what he's doing. He's showing the sort of incidental details of life and the way it adds up. It's a little bit like a kind of Mexican version of Jim Jarmusch's early
films.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And whether you like that or not depends on how far you kind of fall under its spell.
That's right. I think because as you say, there's lots of bits where the screen fades to black and we don't see anything. We just hear stuff. And there's lots of just static camera movements, aren't there? The camera's just sort of plonked there.
Yes, he's a kind of tableau style of filmmaker. And do you know the photographer William Eggleston?
It certainly
reminded me like watching a slideshow of William Eggleston.
Yeah, well, it's lots
that
of
it's
telegraph
the it's the telegraph poles and the wires and the slightly overgrown kind of hinterland with truck stops and garages.
But every now and then an ironic sort of thing will happen. A bike will kind of come across that kind of still screen, or a dog will kind of yap across it. And eventually there was a little moment where suddenly I was thinking, oh God, I don't know if I can really do with this. It's a bit mannered. It's a bit sort of Mexican New Wave film school via Sundance. And then suddenly there was a scene where he had to go and walk someone's dog, the old garagista who wasn't going to give him the spare part. He had to walk his dog, and suddenly the sort of that kind of worked brilliantly because the dog suddenly obviously bolted when the screen was fade to black, and all we saw was this tablet with this dog running across the screen and then this bloke going after it going, oh my God, come back.
Yeah, it's a little drip 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 of details that I agree with you entirely, that I was watching it thinking, I'm not really going along with this, and then it did sort of get under my skin, and it does take you to that place, and when you come out you feel that you've actually visited this odd landscape.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not that I'm ever going to as well. If I go to Mexico on holiday, I probably won't be going to this extremely small town.
But now you don't need to. There
seems to be a lot of mechanics though for a very small town.
I wonder if that was a bit of a necessity for the film.
Yes.
But who cares? I like this.
Yeah, no, I did as well. Lake Tahoe, which is not set in Lake Tahoe. It's about dreams as well and the disconnect between places.
It's like Japan. Well.
Japan, exactly, which was also Mexican and wasn't set in Japan. Lake Tahoe by Fernando Henrique. We move to Sunshine Cleaning now, which stars Emily Blunt and Amy Adams and Alan Arkin as a family business set up to clean up crime scenes. It gets a bit icky and ooh if you're a girl having to clean up a mattress where someone has bled to death.
Slow down, Rose.
I'm not going fast.
You are going fast.
No, I'm not. How can I be going faster? I'm walking backward. I have the hard job.
You're in control of it. You're the one pulling it.
I'm pulling it.
I haven't got a good grip on it, Rose.
So we're in Albuquerque for this film, which I thought was rather like Inspector Moore, so I always thought, well, God, there's a lot of people dying in Oxford this year, aren't there? There seem to be a load of murders in Albuquerque for them to clean up.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. Maybe it's because Albuquerque is inherently a bit kooky and odd, so that's why they set it here. The other thing that should be said about this film is that it's another of the Sunshine films from the producers of Little Miss Sunshine. And again, it has the cute kid, it has Alan Arkin as the sort of cantankerous, splenetic old grandpa.
Yeah.
And this felt a little bit like trying to restoke the embers of sort of past glories a bit.
It did. What about the two leads, Amy Adams, who occasionally annoys the hell out of me and sometimes impresses the hell out of me?
I quite like them both in this, and Emily Blunt too as her sister, who are basically sisters forced to take on this job cleaning up crime scenes. You know, I thought that there was a very good black comedy in here trying to get out. It's a film that has a lot of kind of mess and thorny issues about sort of, you know, the economic downturn and sort of certain domestic woes. But all of those are sort of, you know, to push the metaphor, sort of swept to the side a little bit. And this has been a film that's been cleaned up itself.
Yeah, I felt there was a bit of overproduction. As you said, they were trying to cash in on that Little Miss Sunshine kind of feeling, which actually, the one thing about Little Miss Sunshine is that it didn't soft soap the kind of elements.
Yes,
kind of
it had a very good end scene.
It did, didn't it? And it was kind of harsh.
Yeah.
This one, it seems that they've got a harsh story, which is about these girls on hard times, who are other both beautiful women who I can't believe can't get boyfriends in Albuquerque, especially Emily Blunt.
Albuquerque would just think they lucked out if these two women walked in.
If you were a cop in Albuquerque, and these two turned up to clean up all the mess,
you'd think someone was having a joke.
Brilliant. I mean, you at least asked
for
it
was a candid camera.
You've been punked by Ashton Kutcher's cleaning company. They've actually sort of made it into a bit of a sort of chick flick somehow, whereas in fact it was clearly an anti-chick flick in its inception.
I think so. It feels like a film that's been sort of pulled in a various different directions along the sort of production process. And it ends up as a bit of a sort of sitcom that doesn't quite know where it's going.
Yeah, it might work actually as a sitcom, you're right. Is it kind of like
Weeds
Alice's Diner?
Or something like
and that they do this every week.
Yeah.
And then there's that kind of bit where they're looking for their mum, who used to be in a TV movie of the meek serving pecan pie. And it just gets a bit like, oh, that's a bit soppy.
Maybe it will spin out into a sitcom, and then we'll be saying how great it is.
Well, yeah, but it wouldn't star Amy Adams and Emily Blunt. No. I get the feeling that both of them are rather too good. She's good, Emily. She's got that American accent down to a T.
She's great, isn't she? She's really an actor who is going places,
isn't
I
she?
Think. And in this case, to Albuquerque.
Well, brilliant. Hot Rod, Jumping Frog, Albuquerque. Zan Brooks, thank you very much for joining me for the reviews this week. For all of Senor Brooks's critical writings, go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. This week sees the UK release of Rudo y Cursi from Mexican director Carlos Cuarón, reuniting the screen duo of Gael García Bernal and Diego Luna, who starred in Alfonso Cuarón's Y tu mamá también in 2001. This time, the duo are half-brothers Beto, played by Diego, and Tato, played by Gael, who are caught in a love-hate sibling tussle as they go from the rags of rural Mexico to the riches of being star players in rival Mexico City football teams, one a top striker, the other an unbeatable goalie. Perhaps you can tell where this is headed. But I met up with Diego and Gael to find out more about how Rudo y Cursi got there. But first, before we hear from the actors themselves, let's hear the duo in action on the big screen in Rudo y Cursi.
Como les dije cuando los conocí, yo busco y promuevo talento futbolístico.
Ah, ¿y lo de la cantada qué?
No, cantada no, fútbol.
¿De fútbol?
Fútbol.
I'm with Gael García Bernal and Diego Luna. One of them's paid me a pound here. Is this to be easy on you?
I'm not paying you. This is just if you do good.
Okay. Well, guys, your new film, Rudo y Cursi, is coming out now. And congratulations. I enjoyed it. It was great fun seeing you back together. What was it like working together again? Is it the first time you've worked together again since Y tu mamá también, Diego?
It was, yeah. It was 7 years after, and a lot happened. You know, we grow, we're different, we're mature.
Now, well, I don't know about mature, we're more mature.
Yeah, we are like, we're wiser, you know. Mm. Now you can listen to us, in fact, without laughing. You shouldn't laugh. You know? That's a smile, right? Yeah. Not a laugh. Okay. And we got together again with Alfonso and Carlos, you know, the Cuarón brothers. Carlos directed this film. He wrote Y tu mamá también. So it's kind of the same team, family reunion kind of thing.
Because you've been, particularly both of you, have been all over the world, shooting here, filming in the States, directing your own movies. Was it nice to be back where it all began for you, Gael?
Indeed. It has to do more to do with the people that we were working with rather than where it was set. Because Alfonso and Carlos are the people that introduced us to cinema. In its most broad expression. I mean, they were the ones that invited us to see how films were made in a way and to participate in them, and we owe a lot to them.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it felt very close to home. And also that experience was one of the first experiences we had in cinema, and we had it together. So definitely it feels like going back home, but in a much more... when things have changed, you know.
But this, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's still a story of journeys in Mexico. There's still a similarity between Y tu mamá también and Ludo y Corsi. There's a journey from innocence to experience for your characters again this time, Diego.
And also, I mean, there's a lot in common, I think. Basically, because the writer is the same guy, you know, but the film has many layers, you know. It's like, and Y tu mamá también had that, you know, you could have go deeper and deeper and always find something. And this film has the same, you know. At the beginning, you can feel you're just watching a film that is going to make you feel good, and you're going to laugh a little bit and get sad probably at the end, and that's it. But then if you keep going, I mean, there is a portrait of Mexico today, you know, or a little piece of Mexico. Yeah. And what I like and love from the film and from what Carlos writes is the humor he finds everywhere, you know, and the way he finds the way to laugh, you know, about really sad issues, you know.
It is interesting because with Y tu mamá también, it's quite obvious that it's a comedy, and then as the journey progresses, it becomes more social and more political and more subtle with its comments on the world outside. Your two kind of kids are very sheltered kids. But the kids you play in this film are slightly older, obviously, because you are. But they also their journey is a different journey. Just tell us a bit about your character in this, Gael.
Yeah, well, they come from very different backgrounds from the characters of Y tu mamá también. They work in a banana plantation, and they were practically born there, and they've worked there most of their lives, I guess. My character is called Eduardo Jesús, El Tato Verduzco Lamarque, and he's nicknamed El Cursi, which means the corny one.
The corny one?
Yeah, the corny one, kind of. And so what he wants in life is really to become a famous singer. He has a strong passion for music, and he doesn't have the talent, but he has a strong passion for music.
I didn't want to offend you, but you know, he's not the greatest singer in the world.
Well, no, of course the film itself says that. What his big talent is to play football.
And he's quite good as well, and good at penalties. Little shimmy of the foot, little dummy.
Well, you witnessed a bit of the magic.
Yeah.
But the thing is that in real life, you will never know if I'm good at playing football or good at singing. It's we need a ball and a microphone to prove it.
We got a microphone. Yeah, you're not getting on my ball. I have to tell you that. And so your brother in the film, Rudo, is you. Rudo means the kind of, does it mean the brute?
The brute, the rude, the tough, sometimes the dumb, you know, it can also... I play, Beto, El Rudo Verduzco, which is an amazing goalkeeper from Tlachatlán, a little town in the coast, in the Pacific coast of Mexico. So Rudo is a really fun guy to... I mean, it's a guy that cares a lot about his family, and loves football, and he's willing to give up everything, you know, in the search for the dream.
Yeah.
But he has a little problem. It's a gambling problem, you know, that gets in between.
He's quite a good goalkeeper. Are you a good goalkeeper? Because I think that's... I mean, I play football, but being a goalkeeper is totally different. I can save, but the catching, coming for the crosses is really difficult, and you do that really well.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you had a chance to watch also my magic and that you recognize...
Even though it's not what you're really good at.
Uh-huh. No, exactly. No.
What are you really good at?
At gambling. I hate the position, I have to say. I trained a lot to do those little things. And since then, I haven't tried to be a goalkeeper again. It's painful, you know. Yeah. You if your team plays well, you become part of the audience in a way. You never get to any action. And, I mean, there's more goalkeepers that are remembered for, you know, fucking up stuff than from being heroes.
Yeah, no, it's always the mistakes, isn't it?
Yeah, and just the idea, I mean... As a metaphor, like a guy that gets in between the goals, I mean, that has to stop the goals You know, it makes no sense. You know, I like the ones that score, the ones that are there to celebrate. This is true.
You're not, you shouldn't be a hero for stopping the creativity.
Yeah.
It's about family as well, because it's not just the Cuarons who are working on this. This is made by Cha Cha Cha, which is Alfonso, Guillermo del Toro, and Iñárritu as well. Uh-huh. Is the production company. It's a Mexican family product, this film. It's like from the whole of the Mexican New Wave is in this film. And you guys are part of that.
But yeah, I mean, Alfonso says it right. Now they have a company, but it's been like that from the beginning, you know. Normally, when Alejandro works, he gets Carlos to give him notes and read the script. And on the editing process, there's Alfonso and Guillermo. And when when I shot my documentary, I went to Alfonso, show him a cut. He gave me many notes. I went back to work. I mean, it's the way we do it. And I think that is really cool to know that you're surrounded by friends that kind of care for the same things you care, that are talented, that have a vision, and that are willing to help, you know?
Yeah. Well, congratulations. I'm very glad that you're here. And congratulations on Rudo y Cursi, because it's our film of the week. We loved it very much.
And,
Wow.
That's an honor. Diego Luna, Gael Cibernal. Muchas gracias, hermanos.
Gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Un gran gracias one more time to Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna. And believe me, they are as handsome and charming in the flesh as they sound. Rudo y Cursi is released here this Friday, the 26th of June. Thanks to all my guests on Film Weekly this week. Do join us on Twitter, Film Weekly. That's the one. We're 27 followers and counting. We're also on Facebook, Film Weekly fans. As always, do pick up The Observer this Sunday for me sitting in for the great Philip French. I'll be reviewing every film released in the UK this week. And the music that you can hear at various points throughout the show has been taken from the Rudo y Cursi soundtrack. It's superb. Before you go and check that out, I've got to say goodbye. So from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, on Film Weekly this week, it's adios y hasta la próxima.